Okay, we are back with the Battleborn Duckers podcast, and we got one of our favorite guests back in the studio today, Mr. Doug Nelson from Endow, and we brought him back for to kind of talk about one of our favorite events we have coming up, and it's one that means a lot to me and a lot to my kids. They've gone to it. I mean, that's where we kind of started duck hunting, right, Brian?
Well, we did a lot of it. So we went to Cody, the first Ducks and Donuts we went to. Cody got, he won a brand new set of decoys.
Yeah.
You know, so. And full rigging. And so, you know, the kids have a good time with it. And we've done, you know, we did it when Endow couldn't do it. We kind of did a little one, you know, quietly low key because we couldn't officially be there. But right. And we did a season closer last year with ours. So, but yeah, so it's. Ducks and Donuts with our wonderful Endow people is always great.
Yeah, it's always nice to have somebody do the work for you and have the kids show up and have a good time. So, Doug, why don't you introduce yourself again and let us know a little bit what's going on.
Doug Nielsen, I'm the Conservation Education Supervisor for the Nevada Department of Wildlife in the Southern Region, Las Vegas. And basically what that means, I wear a lot of hats, but one of the hats I wear is over our education programs. And, you know, this Ducks and Donuts, we were kind of brainstorming at work, how on earth can we get more kids involved with our youth waterfowl hunt out at the Overton Wildlife Management Area, and it just kind of slowly baked over a few weeks, and then the idea came up, well, why don't we just do something simple, or, you know, offer them something warm to drink and a donut, hence the name Ducks and Donuts. And that the first one was in 2018, and that's what we started out with. We got some help from WIN, Wildlife and Habitat Improvement of Nevada, gave us some donations, and the Las Vegas Woods and Waters Club gave us some donations, because we can't use the money that we have in our budget to buy things like food items for the public. So in order to make that happen, we had to get some donations. And then I'm at this event. It's early in the morning. It kicks off at 4 o'clock, and maybe it was you that told me, hey, this guy from Pahrump wants to give away a shotgun. And I'm like, what? And it was Arms Corps, Sean Fairbairn from Arms Corps and Rock Island Armory. He wants to give away a shotgun. So he came over and we had a drawing for that. And the kid went home with a brand new shotgun. So it was a great event. And I think it's just going to get bigger.
Man, Rock Island Armory and Arms Corps, man, those guys, they do so much for these kids. They give away a shotgun every year for that stuff. I mean, he's always doing something for these kids, and it's not just the Ducks and Donuts. It's there's a lot of other organizations that they put the money out for and do that part, and you know, they make a really good 1911 too. So I mean, it's a good thing. But yeah, anytime we can get a group to come step out and just say, hey, we're gonna do something good for the kids. I know Woods and Waters, Ron and I for WIN, we're big about trying to get the money to make sure that goes back to that. That's what one of our events we do every single year. We try to give to that. And Mike's been really good with the Woods and Waters group. And I know we got, man, who else we got? I think High Rock Construction, I think this year gave some money for that.
Yeah, like because of WIN, because Endow has a hard time. Their hands are really tied when it comes to it. And so us knowing big duck hunters in the community, we went out and pounded the pavement a little bit and said, hey, give a little bit. And, you know, we had John Hymas, who's a big duck hunter, has had boys go through the program. He's been out at youth hunts. He stepped up and gave some money too, which WIN used to buy stuff for Ducks and Donuts. We had Coots at Coots Taxidermy. He's donated a free shoulder mount. And then WIN also donated some 12-gauge ammo along with a lot of little things. So it should be a great time when the kids come out this year. And something I want to tell you about Sean Fairbairn and his little Armory, they're all the way out of Pahrump. And so he gets up so early in the morning. I was talking to him last year. He's like, I get up around 1 or 2. I'm like, what the crap? And he drives all the way out there because he loves hunting. He loves those kids. He gives away a gun to the kids, and then he drives all the way back home. I can't say enough good things about that guy.
That's a heck of a, you know, for me, giving up my sleep to do something like that, and for him to drive all the way out there and do that—that's commitment right there. That's dedication.
And he doesn't miss a year. You know, he does it every single year. So he gets that gun. And now this year, with the way firearms are the way they are, I mean, to still be given a gun is a pretty good thing. I'll tell you, yeah. Ron and I do a lot of the fundraising stuff for a couple different organizations, and it's it's a different thing when you start going and asking people for guns. But I can tell you there's a couple organizations in this, in the Las Vegas Valley, that every time we ask them for something, they step up. And it's, you know, we work a lot with New Frontier Armory. Sean does a lot. So those guys, when you call them and say, hey, this is what I need, those guys just jump up and do it. And so it's important for us as hunters that we make sure that we give back to those organizations that are making these things possible for our different clubs and groups, because we couldn't do the Ducks and Donuts and the wildlife conservation projects and the hunting management programs that a lot of these organizations do without the help from these guys that are just willing to give, you know, they're donating guns, they're donating money, they're donating time. I mean, just to do a banquet, you got to have an FFL there. So yeah, these FFLs could very well charge us $500 to come sit there and do all that paperwork and stuff. Instead, they come and do it and just come and sit with us and take care of all that stuff for us. So it's a great thing. And so I think as hunters, we owe it to them to give back to them any chance we get.
And you might think, oh, they're getting a lot of promotion out of this, you know, and they're going to make some money off of getting their name out there. No, they don't. They get very little in return other than the good feeling. And, you know, the same kind of goes for Endow. You know, like, Endow does not have to put on this event. It's not mandatory. Again, they're kind of going out of their way to get donations. And a lot of, how much staff are you having come out there this year?
Well, I think we'll have 5 Endow staff there. And we go out Friday night. We get everything set up ahead of time. Because in the morning, we just don't have time because it happens so fast and so early. So we get there, we set everything up, and then we try to, you know, go to bed early. And then we're up about 3 o'clock making sure everything's turned on and ready to go. So as soon as the kids get there at 4 o'clock, everything's ready.
Yeah, and with the Endow staff, like, I mean, how many other jobs require you to go to bed late and wake up at 3 a.m. and then deal with a bunch of public and kids? You know, it has to be a little bit of a labor of love. It can't just be like, making a paycheck. Am I right?
You know what? Let me tell you, there are jobs in this world that people got a job and they're a good job, but they just happen into it. It's not something they dreamed about. These people that work for the Nevada Department of Wildlife, they laid awake at night as high school students going, when I grow up, I want to do this. And they did all the work to get there, all the sacrifice and education and everything in order to get where they're at. And these aren't jobs where these guys are going to go home and buy a bass boat and a cabin and all that stuff. They don't pay that kind of money. So they're there. I mean, you know, we make a good living. But my point being this, is that they're not there to get rich. They are there to give back to the resource, whether you're talking about an educator or a biologist. And so when they have an opportunity to give to the kids, I really wish people could see the face of the Endow person or our volunteers who work in hunter education and angler education when they get to help a kid. I mean, it's there. And our volunteers are just amazing people.
Yeah, I remember walking out of the last one. I don't remember which one it was, but I remember walking out with my kids, and you go out and hunt with the kids, and Endow's giving them all these crazy calls, and it's like trying to herd cats and keep them in the blind, and you have kids that don't want to shoot. That's how Brandon sounds in a regular call. You have kids that don't want to shoot. You have kids that want to shoot. And then you have kids that want to leave, like, as soon as they get in the blind, as soon as the donuts are gone, they're ready to go home. And so as a dad, and you're hauling all these kids out, and you're going out of the check station at the end of it, and there's these Endow volunteers, and they're just like smiles ear to ear, and you're like, why are you so happy? Yeah, and I guess that makes sense after explaining that to me.
And people don't understand. I mean, our state staff, our Endow staff, I mean, you look at what the salaries are, you just look at government salaries just in general. So everybody on that staff could go take a job with a different government organization or a quasi-government organization and take a pretty significant raise with it. So they're not there. I mean, yeah, there's a good retirement there, but you can get, you know, just as good a retirement going some other places. So they're doing it for the love of what they do, and they're doing it because they get to have these interactions. A lot of them are with a biologist. That's one of the few places you can do some of the things that they do, right? So you're not going to get the opportunity a lot of times to go out and ban ducks if you're outside of an organization like that. So you could go work for, you know, go to the county and be a biologist for the county or the water district or one of those, probably make a little bit more money, but it's a different job. So your focus is going to be different. So it's great that we have people that are willing to make those sacrifices to make it so much better for the rest of us. The programs, I mean, I'll tell you that Endow has got some of the best biology programs that they're going to be in the state. And so when as hunters, we're looking for an answer to a question.
Data.
So if I want to know what's happening with ducks, you know, what the season looks like. Hey, you know, what does it look like over in this area? We can call a biologist and say, hey, what's it going to look like this year? You know, how's everything doing? What's the drought causing? What's our hatch rates? So they're going to have all that information. And so that's very valuable for every hunter. So we're setting quotas and limits based on what those biologists are doing every single day. And so we're seeing a big one with the coyote fight right now. So that's one of the big arguments is there just hasn't been the money put towards that because it's an unregulated species.
To study predation,
so,
yeah.
So Endow hasn't put their biological staff on it like they have the mule deer and the antelope and the animals that are regulated because they need to focus those on the regulated species so we can make that the best possible. And they have a challenge. I mean, we're looking at deer populations now being they're on a 30-year decline and they're going down every year. So how we manage it. So the biologists are actively looking for ways to do it with the waterfowl. I mean, we have some excellent resources in the biological community with the waterfowl. So one of the great things that we've got to be involved with the wind group is providing some resources so we can do some captures so we can band some ducks. Right. And so this year it's increased that in Southern Nevada. We've never really had that resource available to us in Southern Nevada, but they're banding ducks in Southern Nevada now. So we'll have an idea because of what Endow is doing and their staff will have an idea of what's happening to the ducks in Southern Nevada, where they're going, what's coming in. So that'll help all of us in the long term. So,
well, that's the key with so much. It's knowledge and information, right? And one of the things that, if people really, it's not light reading, but if they want to go see that annual report that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service puts out on waterfowl reproduction and all that takes place up in Canada and the northern bands of the United States.
Boreal forest.
Yep. And they can, but one of the keys, and people don't like to hear this, but one of the keys in that report always is the condition of the habitat. But if you look at what Wynn focuses on their work on habitat, if you look at Ducks Unlimited, the millions of acres that they've conserved in some form or fashion, it's all because of habitat. Without habitat, you can't have wildlife. It's real important for us to understand how all that works. If we don't have the wetlands, the ponds and things like that up in that northern tier of states and on into Canada, you're not going to have that reproduction. And so, I mean, even things like feeding the ducks at a local park impacts waterfowl populations.
Why?
Because two things, the things we feed them hurt them.
Yeah.
And then it because they find that they have water here and people are willing to come and give me popcorn. Why do I want to migrate? I'm just going to hang out. So then that interrupts migration.
Same reason I have a hard time leaving the couch, but go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's all the same. I mean,
getting out of the boat.
Really? It's how much is it going to cost me in energy to go get that food versus what I'm given?
Well, there's two things that move ducks, right? So there's, you're either going to have, generally what moves ducks from the north to the south is the freeze, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not talking 6 inches of snow. You're talking 2 foot of snow. Yeah. They can no longer get to the food source. So that'll push the ducks. The other thing that pushes them is hunting pressure, right? So what do you have when you have a big park and everybody's throwing their bread out there for the ducks and the ducks have all this unlimited food? You're not allowed to hunt, so they now have a safe zone. There's no reason for them to push onto that migration. And so it does a ton. And this year, we have a bit of an issue this year because of the drought being the way it is. I was listening to a Ducks Unlimited podcast, and if you haven't listened to it, there's a series on the drought. And it focuses in the one that really is real relevant to us is the California section of that drought. So we get a lot from the Los Banos area and stuff like that. So that migration path comes and feeds into our Pacific flyway. What they're saying is a lot of those ducks either in the marshes, but 80% of the ducks are actually feeding in the flooded rice fields. Well, there's going to be like a 75 or 80% reduction in the flooded rice fields this year because of the lack of water. So farmers now are going to have to take that and till it under so they can get the decomposition of those rice stalks. That takes all the food source out of there. So those ducks that would normally spend a bunch of time in that central California area up in that Los Banos marsh area and Merced, Modesto, all that stuff, they're not going to be there because there's no water for them to be there. Or you're going to get 10% of the ducks that were there as normal. So now that is the number one teal area in the United States. They have more teal there harvested than anywhere else in the United States. So that's going to devastate the teal population. The other thing is they haven't had any nesting opportunities there because there's no water. You look at just in the state of Nevada up north. Look at those reservoirs up north. There's no water in those reservoirs up north. So those,
where we hunted last year, Bass Lake's now dry.
Those ducks are going to be artificially forced south earlier than they normally would because they're coming into where they normally would have those early wintering water holes. And there's no water, so they have to fly past it, and some of them aren't going to make it. So you're going to have some predation loss, a lot more predation loss because now we've got with those shrinking water sources, we have less cover. And so the predation loss is going to be higher. There's going to be more birds that can't find food between the dry patches, and they're going to die of starvation. So you got all these things working against us. The good thing for Southern Nevada is we are going to be a primary stopping point that we wouldn't normally be because it's the only water left. So it's a big thing. And so NDOT does a great job of trying to manage, you know, our artificial. We do a lot of artificial here. So with our WMAs and stuff, with how those managers move water and keep water and when we put water on fields and stuff like that, we do a great job of trying to give them a habitat to stay in. Now, is it perfect? Would we love to have cornfields everywhere, you know, we can have on these WMAs? That'd be great. But it's just not reality. So they do a great job of managing those resources.
Yeah, we're never gonna mimic a Mississippi flyway. That's just not gonna happen because of where we're at. But we can take what we have available and make the best use of it we can. And one of the other things that we need to probably mention, and I personally don't know these individuals by name, but we work with some of the landowners, those who have water rights and things like that up by like Key Pittman. And negotiate with them and work our water with their water so they get what they need for their agricultural purposes. And then we get some to work with Frenchie and Nesbitt up there at Key Pittman. And we similar things. We work with Water District and other things down here to try to make sure we got water on the Overton Wildlife Management Area. But it's not just a thing where you go in and flip a switch and shazam, everything's done. It takes a lot of work, a lot of cooperation with folks who are willing to give a little so that wildlife can have what they
have.
It's
great because
interesting because I was just talking to one of the managers up at the Key Pittman area, and he said that if we could spread the word that if you have drawn an opening day at Key Pittman, you better come and scout because there is no water. And he just today got 16 hours to dry up into Frenchie, and Frenchie's bone dry. And so if you have that opening tag up there this year, he said, please get the word out that they have to come and scout or there's not going to be opportunities for them.
Yeah, and that's we actually sat down with Andrew, and that podcast will come out. We're waiting on the NDAL approval for that podcast to get released. But that podcast will come out, and it talks a lot about just what it takes for him and you know how limited he is about where he moves his water. Mm-hmm. So once it hits that French area, that it's locked in there, right? It's gonna die there. So that's it's gonna evaporate out of there.
Yeah, it doesn't go anywhere else.
And so there's no way for him to move it back up to the other ponds. But he talked to us a lot about, you know, having the ranchers where they take their water at certain times so he can have water when he needs it, and how that WMA, how it's managed for both ducks and doves
and deer.
He's got to keep the fishery open as well. So, you know, it's a lot of juggling those guys have to do. And I think people don't realize how government agency works a little bit because you hear a lot of complaints of, well, they don't do this and they don't do that. And I'm like, okay, well, do you know what they do? And here's what they do. And here's what they have to spread it on is they can't just go spend everything in their budget doing just one thing. They have specific line items. And if they're out of money in the budget for that particular project, they're done. That project waits till they get more money in the budget. So they can't go back and just do, you know, I want to go and build another duck marsh. Well, no, that's not going to work. So, and then there's things that are required out of them that are outside of the realm of what sportsmen want to see. There's, you know, noxious weed control and
dace,
protecting endangered species and all that goes into that. And they do a really good job to make it open for all the sportsmen. And NDAO does a great job in the state of Nevada. We're very lucky because NDAO is that there are public lands. And so the state of Nevada is unlike most states, especially if you go back the central, southern, eastern United States, we have public land everywhere. And so those lands are managed by Indals getting up there and going into the wilderness and doing these things so we can have places to hunt. Go to Louisiana and try to find a public land to hunt on.
Well, you know, we really, when you think about just what, and you see different percentages, but we're somewhere right around that mid 80 percentile of publicly owned land in Nevada. Now, some of that, of course, falls within the military reservations, and you can't go running around out there for obvious reasons, but that still leaves
you'll get abducted.
I mean,
start probing you.
but I mean, you literally, you can go almost any point of the direction and find yourself somewhere where you can go without having to ask somebody's leave to do it. That is a real blessing and amazing thing. But part of that is, you know, when we start looking at wildlife management activities, for instance, that people don't realize, Southern Nevada is a very important example of this. You have just within 25 miles of Las Vegas, you have military agencies. You have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You have the U.S. Forest Service. You have the Bureau of Land Management. You have the Bureau of Reclamation. You have the National Park Service. That's just off the stop. That doesn't stop at account. Oh, we also have Native American lands and the Indian reservations, which bring in another level. And all those organizations are involved in some form or fashion somewhere with the decisions and choices that are made at the Nevada Department of Wildlife level. And we have to function a lot of the things that we do within their regulatory process that governs what we can and can't do as a state. It could be anything from the Endangered Species Act to a superintendent's compendium at Lake Mead, which outlines what can and can't be done at Lake Mead within a regulatory framework established in, Title 16, Chapter 36. But anyway, so there's all these levels that govern what we can do. And so like something is that would seem as simple as, oh, we'll go move some sheep. It's not that easy. That's usually 2, 3, 4 years in the process, identifying the source herds, identifying where they would go, determining if there's a disease issue or not, because you don't want to be moving diseased animals all over. So you have to check that. I mean, there's a lot that goes into these things. It's not something that somebody gets together over a beer and decides what they're going to do.
Well, even on the Overton WMA, part of it's state park. And so like when they want to even like improve a road out there, they have to go get approval from Lake Mead National Recreation Area.
So you got three areas out there. So you got the Lake Mead National Recreation Area that kind of butts up into the end of it. But you've got BLM land that also is owned there. So that just that WMA, anytime they want to do anything on that WMA, they have to get all the stakeholders involved. And it's, you know, it gets to the point where, hey, we want to go take care of these weeds. And it goes to the federal level and the feds say, well, no, we're going to take care of the weeds and you're going to pay us to do it. So, you know, it's all those little nuances. And then on top of it, if you want to do anything from a standpoint of building anything out there that's going to access that highway right there, well, then you start getting into county permitting issues. So then you're dealing with the county issue and then you're having to come back. I know we have Endow and state guys into the town board. So I serve on the town board out there. And so they're in the town board talking to us and say, hey, this is what we got on the horizon. This is how we're going to do things like that. And so it's all this stuff that people don't realize what goes on behind the scenes that would change their outlook. We had some guys in a meeting one time complaining about the WMA managers and they don't do anything of this and that. And so Mike Reese and I were there and we kind of gave him the 1-2 punch and it was like, no, this is what they do. And this is the parameters they have to work within. And so they can't just focus in on that one thing. They have to do all these other 100 things. Yeah. And there's actually, it's pretty interesting. I think you probably find them on any state WMA. They all have a master plan. So I think it's a 10-year master plan. I could be wrong, but it outlines everything that WMA manager has done and is supposed to do in that 10 years and kind of what they would like the vision to be in that next 10 years. So I know there's some that, yeah, we'd like to put another pond in out here. And so if there's funding available, then that would be already starting to kind of be in the works. But it says, hey, you need to spend 30% of your time on noxious weed control. You need to spend 10% of your time on this. And so it goes through every single thing that those WMA managers touch. is all detailed in that management plan.
Including use of that facility.
Yes.
So we're talking about, yes, waterfowl hunting. That's one use. But there's also the idea of a rest over area for the passing waterfowl. That's why there's a rest day in between. But then you also have people that don't hunt. Then they have as much right to access that managed area as somebody who doesn't hunt. And so we need to make sure that there's opportunities there for people who want to go birding or take pictures of wildlife. And I mean, there's all these levels.
And then you have the retriever club too that wants to run their dogs on there.
Right. You have that. And then you have people like me. I want to go out and fly fish for bass. And there's a small window of opportunity because of the way the regulations read between when a water becomes open out there and then the beginning of waterfowl season. And then it's over and it's only a couple of weeks and you can't put a kayak or a float tube out there. So you're out there. You go, well, I'm going to have to go, wade.
Yeah.
And so they've got to balance all those uses, and then those have to be again balanced over interest of we were looking at doing some things out there recreationally a few years ago. We had to go present our concept to a committee down in Boulder City, Lake Mead National Recreation Area, and they had a chance to say, well, no, we don't like that activity out there. You're gonna have to do something else. So there's a lot involved. I wish I could help people understand it. You know, one of the greatest ways to just get a picture of what it takes to do something is to attend a meeting of the State Board of Wildlife Commissioners.
That tells you, I mean, that does a whole lot. Ron and I have been to several of those. We do also do our local cabs, so you can go to those meetings. The county cab will make suggestions to go back to the Wildlife Commission and say, hey, this is what Clark County wants, or this is what Nye County wants, or Lincoln County. So they all have their own county board of wildlife, basically, mm-hmm. and their advisory to the cab. But there's a lot of documents that are available, and you just got to look for them. So the management plans. And the hard part is, not only do we have to manage for all the people that want to use the land, but then we also have to do species management, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure we're managing our fisheries appropriately. So not only do we have a viable fish population, but we have a viable good fish population. So if they're overbreeding and we're not culling them enough, they're going to be tiny fish and they're not going to be healthy. We're going to be fighting for food and the resources are going to be scarce, and you're going to have an issue with that ecosystem. And we have to manage, you know, a dace population here or a suckerfish population over there. And so all of that stuff makes a play into it. So if you, I will tell you one of the best things I did to really understand how it works is to get a hold of some of those management plans and look at them, because it'll tell you, it'll say, okay, these are the endangered species this WMA is managing right here. And I know just in Overton, I mean, there's the willow flycatcher out there. And there's a bunch of endangered species. They got desert tortoise out there. But you're also managing a fox population that's, you know, predatory to the birds, and a coyote population. So all those things have to have their place, and they all require attention. And when you're talking to WMA that has two regular full-time staff most of the time, and then sometimes a seasonal staff, it's three guys, doesn't go very far.
Oh, that's a lot of work.
This is something I like about Brian. He's very scholarly in his pursuits of these things and reads these management plans where a lot of guys don't even know where to find them. And that kind of brings it back to the youth duck hunt, is like, this, we need more people like Brian. We need more people that are willing to look into it, willing to understand the process, and willing to try to figure out how to fix it, you know, whether it gets involved in conservation groups or just being educated or making those phone calls, because guys at NDAO will talk to you all the time. But kind of like the way you get them started is get into these youth duck hunts. So what advice would you give to somebody that was going to go to one of these youth hunts, like a father or parent?
Well, you know, first thing is just come with an educator's mindset, because when you're there as a mentor, whether you're a dad, a granddad, a grandmother, aunt, uncle, whatever your capacity is, you're there with that youth as a mentor. You're not there hunting that day. So it's their hunt. So if we come prepared to give them the attention, give them that one-on-one, and then take the opportunity to teach them, while you're sitting there and you're blind in the dark and you hear the noises of the morning as the birds start waking up, teach them about things we've been talking about, habitat, how it works, what the role hunters play. You know, the greatest story, I call it the greatest story rarely told, is the role that hunters play in conservation in the United States. We are the first conservationists. Back at the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s, it was hunters who recognized that there was an issue with wildlife populations. While their focus was on huntable populations to start with, everything's tied together. And it impacts those non-huntable species as well. And so the work that was done to lay the groundwork, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, he was a hunter, conservationist, and he did great things for the country and for conservation. And then that rolled in. Then we get into the middle of the Depression, and you have the Pittman-Robertson Act, which is how even today most wildlife management is funded on a state level, and that's with excise taxes on arms and ammunition, and archery eventually was added, archery tackle. Dingell Johnson Act in the early 1950s, which was patterned after Pittman-Robertson. And all of those are excise taxes on things that sportsmen and women use in the field every day. And that money is what provides bulk of the funding for wildlife management in the United States. But the other aspect, if we talked about some of these groups that support this activity, like Ducks and Donut, you look at Wynn, the money that Wynn raises every year at their banquet, Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn raises at their banquet, Las Vegas Woods and Waters, Nevada Bighorns Unlimited, and that money, those last four groups, stays right here. It's used in Nevada.
And it's a lot.
On Nevada Project, it's a lot of money.
People don't realize, I mean, I think just the Wynn banquet the last year we did, I think what we were in $70,000 or something.
And we're
like
a
that.
Small group, Bighorn fraternities, millions.
Yeah, so you're looking at, you know, you're looking at easily $500,000 a year from these wildlife groups and money that's going to probably just a guzzler to build a guzzler for the Bighorn sheep. Yeah. It's not a cheap project. They're putting probably $100,000 into just shipping water.
Well, and here's a perfect example. When we started the Nevada National Archery in the Schools program in 2009, and we brought that and started setting it up. We set it up right here in the Las Vegas area, the southern region. Nevada Bighorns Unlimited is based out of Reno, and they gave us $40,000 the first couple of years just to help schools get the equipment they need to run that program. Keep in mind that every kid that takes up archery, buys a bow, starts shooting arrows, is now pumping money into wildlife conservation because a percentage of those eventually through the manufacturers is collected as an excise tax. And then that comes back to fund wildlife management throughout the United States and our territories. So it's an amazing thing.
Well, and it doesn't take, I mean, the sad part is we think about it's a tax, right? So as soon as you say a tax, it's like, oh, the government taxed us. Well, no, the government didn't tax us. The sportsmen went to the government and said, we need to do something about conservation. Let's do this. And so the sportsman is saying, hey, take our money. Take our money because we need to preserve these resources. And so you tell me what other group, I don't care, you football, baseball, volleyball, rock hounding, PETA, whatever you want to do, you tell me what other group is asking to be taxed so they have the opportunity to do what they enjoy.
It isn't happening.
It's because there's something like you said early in the morning, waking up with whomever's with you, your friend, your dad, your brother, just some older person that could take you out to this youth duck hunt. There's something magical about that first sunlight coming up and watching those ducks come in. And I tell a lot of parents, because I grew up hunting, but I didn't grow up duck hunting. And other hunting's hard. You're waking up early, you're chasing deer all week, and you might not get one. There's no success. You're chasing upland game, you're running through the hills, you know. But this youth duck hunt is really beautiful because you wake up, and Dell feeds your donuts, you get prizes.
We're on elite two or three boxes.
Yeah, minimum. They have the wrong boxes. No, and then you wander out to the duck blind, and you get to sit there in the quiet with your kids, you know. And you might not shoot one, but you get to watch a sunrise with your kids. You get to tell them about their grandpa's hunting stories. You get to tell them about conservation. You get to tell them about how much you hate people that don't pick up trash. That's what my kids hear all about, you know. And then you might shoot a duck. You might shoot a coot. Your dog goes out and gets it. And they just have a good time, and they're warm, and they're happy, and they're fed, and they got prizes. And then you leave, and Endel gives you food when you leave again. And so, like, all in all, if you want to get a new generation to love hunting, I think duck hunting at Overton specifically is a great place to do it. And it's a great place to engender a love of hunting, a love of wildlife, which will then lead to a love of conservation and make the outdoors better for everybody.
And at the same point, you can ruin it as a parent too, right? So you take a kid out, get him up at 3 o'clock in the morning, take him out hunting, and then you start screaming
at
him.
It is hard to ruin it at Overton.
Yeah, but you scream at him because they didn't hit a duck, or you know, you're just overly aggressive. It can turn a kid off to hunting. And so it's a big thing for parents to understand when you're taking a kid out. They got to be on their time, on their schedule, and it's got to be enjoyable for them. The idea is to get them to want to come back.
Yeah, we want to give them a taste, right? And the biggest problem is that as adults, we've been through all that. We've trained ourselves to be patient. We've trained ourselves to sit in a blind for hours, or to sit on a hillside with binoculars for hours doing the glassing. The kids aren't there yet. It's the same thing with fishing. So the key is you get them out there, you get them started, give them a taste. And when they start doing something else and they start losing their focus, don't bark them back into where you want. That's probably time to start doing something else. And so you might have somebody in your group that's only good for 30 or 40 minutes at first daylight, and then they're ready to go do something else. And that's okay. That's okay. You're not there for you. You're there for them. And that's what we need to do. So I appreciate your remark.
Something great with Overton, though, is you do have 4G. So if you're bringing your, you know, I'll bring them all the way down to 5 years old. At 5 years old, you get to go under five. It's just a mess. And I've done under five. It's a mess. But at 5 years old, if he gets too anxious or anything, you have 4G on that whole WMA. And so you just give him your phone and the other ones could enjoy it. You give him your phone. You give him a blanket. You know, some hot chocolate, and they'll sit there and watch videos where the other kids are able to enjoy the outdoors.
Well, and you got to realize too, you're in a, you think of it, it's a big WMA, right? It's a fairly decent sized WMA, but those blinds aren't necessarily all that far apart.
Right.
So one of the things we need to watch, especially with our younger kids, you got five kids in there and your youngest one, and well, let's just go for a walk. Well, you're going to affect somebody else's hunt at the same time. So we just got to be careful when we do those things. Find some things for them to do. If it's time to leave, it's time to leave. If we can get them to hold out till it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock when the ducks are done running, because you're going to have the great thing about this youth hunt is you have everything from 5 years old all the way up to 17 and a half year old kid. That's his very last youth duck hunt, right? So you've got all those things. So 17 year old kids, they're going to be a lot of times more experienced, but I'll tell you, I've got a couple 17 year old kids coming out this year. They've hunted just about everything on the planet. They've never hunted ducks before. So for them, it's going to be an experience. Yeah. And we're going to put Nevada Mullet. We're going to send Cody with those kids. And he's 18. And so they know each other. And so he'll be able to kind of mentor them into a new form of hunting. So you're going to develop a hunter at 17, the same way you developed a hunter at five. And so the other thing is finding out if you've got people, Ron and I have got a ton of people coming out that have never, their kids have never hunted. The dads might never have hunted.
We're excited to have them.
So we've got some mentors coming out to go with those groups. So we can not only get the kids excited, but the dads are going to sit in that blind with them and see what it's all about. And I'll tell you, there's something really nice about sitting on the water and watching that sun come up and just the beauty of being out there. And you know, the cool thing about hunting is you do it in pretty beautiful places. And so it's no different with waterfowl. That sun comes up and you get those pinks and purples and, you know, the reflections off the water. And it's a pretty awesome place to be. So those dads are going to get the bug when their kids, you know, a kid harvests a duck and you've never harvested a duck. Now dad's going to want to go hunting.
I've taken some pictures at Overton during the fall and you get those colors reflecting off the bluffs right there in that early morning. And it's
a beautiful
pretty.
Thing.
It's pretty. You don't think of it being here, but it's there. One of the things we probably ought to point out so people don't feel like it's a free-for-all going out there, this is a very regimented process. Everybody that's going to come and hunt there has to have a reservation. They can start making those at 8 o'clock Monday morning, the 18th. They can call this number, 855-542-6369, and they can make those reservations. And so the number of people who can use that are limited, although we have a pretty good sized group that can go out there. And like you mentioned, everybody has a blind that you're assigned to that blind and you have to hunt there until you're ready to leave. And then you can walk out, but you can't go wandering around. And so that number one, it really enhances the safety of the area for these young hunters, and it's very orderly process and everybody's generally pretty friendly and cooperative. So, I think people that come out can have a great time. The other good thing about Overton, it's chilly, but it's not freezing. It's not super cold. So if you give your kid a good jacket, or at least say a blanket for the young ones, if you bring a real young one, to keep them warm. Then once the sun comes up, it warms up pretty good.
The water's shallow. There's not, I mean, if you're in some of the established blinds, most of the time the water's not, it's not muddy. You know, you're out some of the areas, it gets a little bit muddy, but the great thing about it is, even if, you know, reservations are going to guarantee you a spot. So if you have a reservation, you're guaranteed a spot. You're guaranteed a blind. But if it comes to it and you hear this podcast on Friday afternoon and, you know, that hunt's on Saturday, on that Saturday morning, if you don't have a reservation, you can come and get on the extras board. And generally there's room left over.
I have never seen a day where there's not room left over.
And it's not. I've seen one during the adult hunt, and I drew the last ball, and every blind was full. But you're not going to get the best blind, maybe not get the choice. But I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, the opener last year was ridiculous.
It didn't matter.
There were ducks everywhere, and so you're going to get the opportunity. You're going to get the opportunity to get on ducks that haven't been educated yet, which is a great thing about the youth opener. Those ducks haven't been shot at since last year, and they're local ducks. They're used to being in there. So they're used to
it. Or they have migrated and sat on the food plot.
Or that too. But there's a lot of ducks that they're used to being in that water.
Have had no pressure.
They know where it is, so they're comfortable. So a lot of times that youth hunt, you're going to get there, it's going to be shooting light, and you're going to have four or five ducks sitting on the water. So it's a good opportunity to get these kids excited and just to see what ducks fly.
Yeah.
You know.
And a couple things with the Battle Born Ducker crew, we do have some other mentors that are ready to come out and mentor you if you want. So if you're listening to this podcast, you're like, I know nothing about duck hunting, you know, Endell's awesome. I'm glad they're putting this on, but I don't know what to do. I don't have any decoys or anything of that nature. Just send us a message on our Facebook and we'll try to hook you up with a mentor that has the decoys and has what you need. Along with that, throw this up on the screen, Brian. I want to kind of show Overton WMA and what we're talking about as far as the, this is a map of the WMA you'll get, and you have three areas that you can make reservations for there. You have the fields right here. You'll have the bull rushes. What bull rushes are is they're basically flooded fields. And so they're about ankle deep. Some of them will go up to your knee depending on where the holes have been made. And then you've got your ponds. You've got Honeybee. You've got Center Pond. You've got Pintail. And you've got Wilson. And all these have several. Here's my Onyx map. Don't steal my points. Anyway, so here's where all the blinds are out here. So this is like Pintail Wilson. And these are all the assigned blinds that you'll be able to pick from, you know. And you'll pick in numerical order based on how you're drawn. So when they call you up, when you call up to Endow, they'll say, hey, do you want to make a field? Do you want to make a bull rush? Do you want to make a pond reservation? And you can make a reservation. You'll draw a bingo ball when you're there. And then when you're there, you get to pick which blind you want based on your numerical order of the bingo ball. Brian always cheats and tips the guy $20 so he can get the premier blind. His kids aged out this year, so we don't have to worry about that this year. But
so if you want a mentor, you know,
you want a mentor,
I only charge a minimal fee.
If you want a mentor, bring $20 and Brian will tip the guy up front. It doesn't work that way. And Dale gets complaints all the time about that. But you have several blinds to choose from, and they're all awesome. Like Brian said, it's a great place to go out and hunt. The bull rushes are kind of the preferred thing for early season. But I know a lot of guys like the lakes. It all kind of depends on what you want. But you can pull up this map at Endow, and this is the Overton WMA map, and you can kind of pick out another important thing that I like to do before my youth hunts, because I've done it quite a bit, is I like to go out and scout the day before. And so you can make it a whole process where you go out the Friday night before, and you're not allowed a car in the WMA, but you can bring a bike. And so you just bring your bike, you ride around, you see where the ducks are at, and you say, okay, this is where I'm going to go tomorrow, and these are the decoys I'm going to put out tomorrow. And if you don't want to do that effort, you could just show up with no decoys and send the blind and still probably be successful. Don't you think, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have better success if you can get a couple decoys, throw them out. But I will tell you, opener, bull rushes are always generally pretty good for opener. The ponds will be okay for opener. The fields, you usually are not going to get much in the fields unless you put a lot of decoys out, because they're not really feeding in the fields. So it's just, they want to be where the water's at. And
unless you're hout, you can shoot in the fields if you're hout for some reason.
And hout sets a lot of decoys too. There's guys that do set a lot of decoys, and you'll see them out there. I know there's some guys, I've talked to one guy that's going to have his kids in the field hunt this year, see what he can do. But, you know, you don't have to.
Talk about waders too, who needs waders and who doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, you really, you kind of need one set of waders, especially with the temperatures the way they've been. I think it was 42 degrees when I left my house this morning. Yeah. So you don't want to be wet first thing in the morning, but you need one pair of waders just to go retrieve ducks and set decoys. That's it. So the kids don't have to have waders.
Walk in sneakers and pants and sweatshirts.
And I'll be honest with you, it's early season. You don't have to go buy a $400 pair of 1600 gram waders. You can go and buy a cheap pair of PVC waders and they'll be just as effective for this early
season. Or hip boots would be fine for the bull rushes.
Hip boots would be fine for the bull rushes.
Not the ponds.
I would not suggest them for the ponds. Some of the ponds are shallow. You start getting to center pond and you're going to be up to your chest. So you're going to fill those hip boots up pretty quick. But a set of PVC waders, you know, you want them with boots just because it's going to be a lot more comfortable and you're not going to get feet wet. But just some easy waders like that. You take those waders, they'll be fine. Throw a set of thermals underneath them. It's going to be plenty. And then once the sun comes up and starts warming up, we're going to be probably in the 70s if the weather holds the way it is. It's going to be super comfortable come 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. So the mornings, that first 3 o'clock in the morning is going to be a little chilly. But as soon as that sun starts to come up and heat it up, it's a really enjoyable hunt.
I was trying to find the pictures of my kids last year during the youth hunt. They all had waders on. You know, they went out in their neoprene waders. And those things get stinking hot, man. Hot. And so I was trying to find it on Facebook. But they're all walking back like rednecks with no shirts on. And then their waders just
hanging down.
And there's some important things. So we're doing this hunt. And so you're going you still have to follow the regulations, right?
Right.
So the youth under the age of 16,
16 and over have to have their stamps.
12 and over have to have a license.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. $15, I think it is still for youth license. 16 and over have to have a stamp.
Federal duck stamp.
Federal duck stamp. You have to have a plug shotgun, so you can't have more than 3 rounds.
And non-lead, and non-toxic shell.
Non-toxic shell, so it's got to be steel, tungsten. You know, I wouldn't be shooting tungsten or bismuth with kids just because you're going to waste a lot of money.
Unless you're rich.
Yeah, if you're rich and you want to shoot some coot with some tungsten, go at it. But, you know, for me personally, the way the weather is, I have thermocells. So it's going to be warm. The mosquitoes are going to be out. It's prime mosquito season. Bring a thermocell, bring some bug spray, bring something, because you're going to be pretty miserable
around
3 days afterwards
with
bumps from head to toe from all the mosquitoes that are out there. So thermocells work really, really great. I think I have 20 of them just about now because we bought a bunch of them that were on clearance.
You ever use one of those thermocells, Doug?
I haven't.
Tell them about Cummins, my favorite story.
They work really good. So it wasn't Cummins, it was Ruby Marsh. So we're sitting in Ruby Marsh, and the mosquitoes were so thick. And the first day, I had the wrong bag with me, and so we didn't have the thermocell. And we got 8 alive. The second day, I had a thermocell, and you could literally – and I'm talking – they're so thick, you could reach out and grab a handful of mosquitoes pretty much. You could take a thermocell, and you lift it up, and mosquitoes went up with the thermocell and then came back down with the thermocell. So it puts like a bubble around you where they don't want to be. And it's kind of like a citronella or something, but you really don't smell it a whole lot. But it uses like a butane cartridge and then pads, and the pads are good for like 4 or 5 hours. And it just heats those pads up. And so if you put one or two of those in your blind, I think they're like $20 a piece.
Sell them at Walmart.
It's going to keep the mosquitoes away from you. You're not going to have to deal with it. You're not going to get eaten alive. Good. If you can get some camouflage to cover faces and stuff like that, that's always good. And it kind of helps keep mosquitoes off.
It's also fun to give your kids face paint and send them home to mom.
Yeah. but the thermocells are probably the best thing I've ever had to deal with mosquitoes. Bug spray doesn't work. We've tried the mosquito wristband things that they have. They didn't work. But these thermocells were really effective. So make sure you're going to take your kids out. We don't want the kids to be miserable. So let's give them every opportunity to not be miserable. So get a thermocell if you can afford one or can find one. You know, make sure that they have a gun that they can shoot effectively. The number one priority is that everybody makes it out of this hunt without anybody getting hurt.
Right.
So make sure we're practicing gun safety with these kids. Make sure we're teaching them right. So get them started. Have the guns on safe. You know, if they miss a duck, it's okay if it's on safety. I'd rather miss a duck on safety.
The ducks aren't that jumpy either. They'll land in the water before you can hand your kid the gun.
Yeah, so.
Well, and you know, there's those four basic principles of firearm safety that we teach in every hunter education class, right? Treat every gun as if it were loaded. Keep the muzzle pointed in a safe direction. Keep your finger off of the trigger until you're ready to shoot. and then make sure your target wants beyond it. If you do those four things, no matter where you're shooting, no matter what you're hunting or target shooting, then you'll never be the cause of a firearms-related accident. Those four things.
Now, something that I think all the parents should take into account is when you're bringing your kids out there and you're hunting, it's supposed to be a good time, and it is going to be a good time. And watching your kid, son, daughter, harvest an animal for the first time and watching that light go on in their eyes, there's nothing better. There's nothing better than that, than being out with your kid and watching them harvest a duck. Last year, we went out for the closer. We went up into the Alamo area with my kid Mitchell, and he'd harvested a duck before, but he jumped this mallard hen. It came off the water, and he just nailed it. It was awesome. And we go back there, and it's a banded mallard hen. And, you know, to this day, now he's like, we were up deer hunting. I'm like, hey, do you want to keep on going? Because it was a hard hunt. And he said, no, we'll just focus on ducks this year.
are there banded deer? I want to shoot a banded deer.
If Mike Reese has his way, there will be banded deer.
Exactly. But the banded deer would be a great thing, because we need to manage that population. We need to know what the population's doing. So collaring a deer, so we can look at movements, find out where they're going. So if they're going into Utah, we need to work with Utah and manage that resource as a collective, right? And so it's not a bad thing to have those things, but that's the thing is, I don't care if it's a kid or if it's a 50-year-old man or an 80-year-old man that's never harvested an animal, or there's something cool about just having somebody be successful and you being a mentor to somebody being successful like that. For me, I'd rather sometimes not harvest an animal, watch somebody else harvest an animal that you're responsible for helping mentor.
Well, you know, they have the
progression of a
progression
hunter.
Of a hunter. Yeah. Thank you, Ron. But that's it. And we go through stages. I mean, when you first start hunting, you want to shoot everything. And if you don't limit out, I mean, you go out on a quail hunt and you come with 14 birds instead of 15, you're all bummed out because you didn't get that 15 bird, but you still have 14 birds, right? But as we get older, those things become less important. And then it's more important how you do it. So that's when you get people who branch off into things like archery or muzzle loading and things like that, because it's different. But then eventually you get to a point, and they call it the mentoring stage, where it's more important to help somebody else. And you get your enjoyment from doing that. And I've been there for a while, and I'll never forget. I've got a daughter. I had five kids, and I've given each one of them an opportunity to hunt. And three of them have decided that they didn't want to do it. But one of those, my youngest son, he's gone now, but he came back and got himself a deer and really got into it. But my youngest daughter, the most girly girl of the three that I have, I mean, she couldn't go hunting without putting on her makeup. And I said, why do we have to put on makeup to go deer hunting, Callie? She says, because I might meet a hot game warden. And if I meet a hot game warden, I have to have my makeup on. And so we did. We had to wait for Callie to put her makeup on. And we went out and we found a little forked horn and some other deer coming up a draw, and we went around the far side of the hill and climbed up, and I said, okay, it's going to come right there. She goes, how do you know? I said, just trust me. It's going to come right there. And I said, as soon as it does, put your rifle on that dead branch of that tree and then do what you want to do. And that deer came up and we took it home. And she just is amazing. She's also harvested a turkey. So you just never know. And you know, when we get together and we talk about it, she thinks about those two hunts. Now, you know, she works for the government of Utah and the agriculture department, and she teaches at BYU part-time and does all these big people things, but she still comes back. Dad, you remember when we went and did that? And when are you going to take me again? I said, well, you live out of state. It's too expensive. So,
well, you know, you've been doing the mentoring game for a really long time, because, and you've, man, you deserve a medal. I mean, you had to mentor this one over here. And so being his scout leader, I'm surprised that didn't like cut you off the mentoring path a long time ago.
It wasn't just me. We had a group of me. Anyways, I remember one point of advice Doug gave me that stuck with me one time. We were just being knuckleheads. I don't remember what we were doing, but I think we went crawling around in abandoned mines and he found us. But he looked at us. He goes, "I know you guys think you're bigger and bad, but there's always going to be somebody bigger and badder than you. So you might as well stop trying." And I said, "He's right. I don't have to be bad."
No, yeah, that probably was the mind. Yeah.
Hey, let's put this ducks and donuts up. Hey, Brian, tell them what time they have to be there for check-in. Well, just so they know.
So you got to be there an hour and a half before shooting light. So that's your time to check in. So if you're an hour and 25 minutes before shooting light, they've already drawn. So once they start the draw, you can no longer check in. So it's very important that you're there an hour and a half before that shooting light. So Ducks and Donuts is going to start at 4 a.m. I don't know what time shooting light is this year.
Shooting light is 6:12 next week.
6:12. So you'd have to be there
4:30
at the
right. That's one of the reasons why we start at 4 a.m. That gives them kind of a reason to be there early for that hunt. So they can get there. They can get their donut and hot chocolate or whatever they want there. And then, they're going to meet that time requirement. And then we get right after it. And so we have our drawing for the gear packages, the prize packages and all that, because we have to get it done before they have to start drawing for their blinds. So we move quick. So if you want to be involved in those things, you want to get there as close to 4 a.m. if you can. And like I say, we get started, we just go one to another. And so if you're there, you'll be good to go on all counts.
A little pro tip is you can let your kids go do the activities and you can go check them all in. Yeah. As long as you have a picture of all their hunting licenses. Yeah, so you can say, "Hey, go have fun, go have some donuts, I'll get you checked in."
And that's the thing, is as long as you're doing that, and there's a couple of requirements. So you have to have the hunting license and stuff you gotta have. Every single blind has to have an adult over the age of 18.
Correct.
They don't have to be a licensed hunter, because you're not allowed to hunt, so there's no need for you to have a license. But you have to have an adult in that blind with them. I know if you look at the Nevada regs, it says if you're over the age of 16, you can hunt on your own. That's not the case with the youth waterfowl hunted over to. It has to have an adult in the blind. Even if you're over the age of 16, you can't hunt by yourself. So it's just kind of one of those things. So it looks like, I mean, it's pretty cool because there's a ton of stuff going on. They'll have the drawings. They'll have, you know, you do donuts and drinks in the morning. So four to five, and then everybody kind of goes off to their blinds. Right. And you want to get up there and get set up and in your blind and have yourself a half an hour probably, just so everything's put out, and that gives you time to get the ducks back into those waters so you're ready for shooting light. But then, you know, if you want to hunt till 8:30, start packing your stuff up at 9 o'clock from 9 to 10:30, so you got an hour and a half, Endow's going to make you some pancakes.
Yep.
So, you know, you get snack breakfast and then the breakfast, and you go home, and if you're in Vegas, by the time you get home, it's time for lunch.
So what more can you ask?
And then you take a nap, and then you wake up the next day.
I guarantee you, your kids will be tired. Like, I guarantee you, my kids go home, and they are non-functional, and they just all fall asleep as soon as they hit that door.
I go home and fall asleep because I'm so tired from doing this. But we have a fun time. And this year, just if anybody's concerned about, we are taking steps with the food items to do everything we can to minimize the chance of COVID exposure. You know, following all of those kind of protocols, like our folks will be wearing gloves and all that stuff, and serving. Like, Sid is just coming up and somebody rummaging through the donuts. We're going to have somebody handing those donuts out, depending on what they want. And when it comes to the breakfast, we'll be cooking the pancakes and whatnot up, and we'll put them in like a clamshell container. They can take them in the butter and the syrup and go do their thing and eat it. But so just so anybody that might be concerned about that, we are taking steps to minimize anything there.
Awesome. Hey, we sent cover a couple of these sponsors at the bottom of the thing. Will you pull that up again, Brian? So who's this Wildlife Restoration?
The Wildlife Restoration is part of that greatest story rarely told. Okay. I talked to you about. That encompasses what we call the Wildlife Restoration and Sport Fish Restoration programs. Okay. And if people go to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service website and just type in Wildlife Restoration, it'll take them to a collection of pages. You can go back and actually see how much money has been collected for wildlife through that program since 1937. The height of the Depression is when this started. That can't be overlooked, because money was at a premium.
Yeah, it was bad.
And so, and that's when that program started. Now, at Pittman Robertson, after its two legislators that really pushed it through, one of those was Senator Key Pittman from Nevada. So Nevada has roots in America's conservation program. Our Senator Key Pittman was one of the sponsors of that bill. And so anyway, so that's what that is. And you look at that, all of those companies or organizations across there are making this event possible. They're making it possible for us to do things that we can't normally do. We couldn't do this without them. And of course, your support from the beginning has been a tremendous thing for us. Your word of mouth advertising of this is amazing, and how you encourage people to come. But really, it's just a real opportunity for us to teach. We can teach not only the safety, but ethics. Ethics are going to be the future of what we do. And that's just something as simple as respecting somebody else's space. I mean, we've all been fishing, you know, when your kid's catching trout, so everybody comes and tries to push your kid out of the hole. But there's fish anywhere. But for some reason, they think because your kid knows what he's doing that they have to come over there. No, we don't do that. We recognize, okay, that's your spot. Here's my spot. Or we recognize people who maybe don't participate in the things that we do. And we show them respect by behaving ourselves. So this is a great teaching opportunity to teach them those things, teach them wildlife conservation, our role in it, and spend that one-on-one time that's so important for us to have. One last thing I would mention in the blind is make sure you got enough adults so that you're not overwhelmed.
Yeah, it can be, especially if you have younger kids, it can get kind of crazy. One of the things that, you know, we talked about all these sponsors for the most part. The one that we didn't hit that really stepped up this year, and I know Ron went and got some of the prizes with some of the money we had from Wynn and stuff, but man, Bass Pro, they really did us a solid and gave us, you know, a pretty substantial discount so we could make sure we could stretch these dollars as far as we could get them.
Made our money go a lot further.
And that's the thing is, so these wildlife organizations, we have to work with Endow on these events because Endow is very limited on what they can do. So they can't go to the Bass Pros and places like that and say, hey, give me something or hey, cut me a break.
Sponsor.
You know, cut me a break. But we can go as wildlife organizations and say, hey, going to Bass Pro, hey, I've got this much money. Here's what I'm going to do with it. I need to make it stretch as far as I can. What can you help me with? And, you know, he gave us some avenues. And
that was all due to Jeremy at Bass Pro Shop.
And Jeremy Ron went out there and talked to him. And he did him a solid. You know, the Arms Corps guys, they're always.
Yeah. Arms Corps and REI, they're the same.
RIA. Right. So RIA is the shotguns that those guys sell. Right. So it's Rock Island Armory, Arms Corps, and RIA.
And if you're looking for a nice 410 for your kid, they have one.
Yeah, it's a great place. But, you know, and that's the thing is we've got partners in the community we have to reach out to, but our government organizations can't do it. So Endow does some great stuff. They do Ducks and Donuts, so we've done Ducks and Donuts quite a bit.
They bring the manpower, which is huge.
Actually, my first Endow youth event, and I've done it. I did it a bunch of times when my kids were younger. Was free fishing day. Usually happens around Father's Day, and I will tell you, I think I probably have 4 or 5 fishing rods from free fishing day that were mine because what they would do is they would give all the kids. They would do a raffle, right? But they had so many fishing rods that every kid got a fishing rod.
Pretty much.
And then when they ran out of kids to get fishing rods to, they gave them to all the parents that came. And so the kids got the opportunity and everything was taken care of. The bait, the fishing rod, everything that kid needed to fish for the day. And they did it. I did one at Lake Mead one time at Boulder Harbor. I did one at Floyd Lamb State Park. They kind of were moving it all over. I'm not sure with COVID how we've done any of that stuff, but it's awesome because the kids walk away with something in their hand. They walk away with a prize. And they, you know, there was fly fishing demonstrations. And they talked about, you know, the biology part of that. And then Endow does a great thing. They spring out to the fair. They would bring the trout tank out to the fair every year. And, you know, the kids could get in there and cast the hook into it.
My kids absolutely love that.
It's a glass tank. If you want
to see someone on the trout tank, Doug will be there.
Just shake his hand. For all those people that have gone to the Bass Pro Shops and decided they wanted to fish the Bass Pro Shops fishing tank, well, Endow lets you do that. They bring the trout and the tank. So, and that's a great program for kids. They do so much to get these kids excited about hunting and fishing. And, you know, we can't thank you guys enough for everything that you do and putting on these programs like Ducks and Donuts.
Well, you know, we, like I say, we really have a good time with it. And because you brought up the fair, I just want to mention that the Clark County Fair organization has played a big role in our presence out there in inviting us. And we have a pretty big footprint at that event. And of course, one of the centerpieces has been that catch and release fish tank, and the fair has actually provided the tank portion while we provided the fish portion. So we got to pat the fair on the back for their contributions, but they understand they talked to me when we first started coming out. We want to do education about wildlife and conservation. And so we do a lot of that. We're still trying to sort out how this year's going to fall out because we missed the last two fairs because of COVID. And this brings me a point you mentioned, like Free Fishing Day, and my folks are bending over backwards trying to create ways to keep these programs going with COVID restrictions in place, because we have to operate under that umbrella, if you will. But they're going out of the way. How can we do this so that we can provide an experience for these kids and families and do it in a way that meets these safety requirements? And it's a challenge. And during COVID, we've been able to do a lot of things. We were able to shift, even though our preference is in person, we were able to shift to virtual. I walked into the garage one day and in our new building over on Pepper Lane in Pecos, we actually have a pull through drive that was there in the building when we got it. And I walked in there and there's all these plastic fish on the floor of the garage. I'm like, what's going on? And I go in there and Abby Zarnecki, our angler education coordinator, has a tablet up on a tripod on the hood of a truck, pointed at these plastic fish. And she's got kids at a park somewhere with their parents and organization, and she's teaching them how to cast a fishing rod online while demonstrating using these plastic fish. I mean, how many people would do that?
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it really is about trying to increase the amount of sportsmen we have out there, and that's the future of, you know, we talk about Second Amendment rights and this and that, but that's the future of holding all that. So if we get kids and we get kids active in the sportsman world, that's going to go a long ways to keeping the rights to fish and hunt. So if
there's nobody left to do it, you know, it's pretty easy for those things to go away. So it's our job as sportsmen to make sure that we have the ability to make that happen long term. So.
Hats off to Endow for being innovative too.
Well, you know, we appreciate the kudos. I mean, we really do. We appreciate the opportunity to be here because we do. We go out of our way to do a lot of things, and we kind of fly below the radar sometimes. And it's real easy to get caught up in what I call barroom politics of wildlife. But really, we've got folks, and they're willing to explain what they do and why we do it. And like we were talking about earlier on the podcast, there's this great big picture of all these things that have to come together in order for wildlife professionals, whether you're talking about Nevada or any state, especially the Western states, because we are so public. All these different organizations are involved, not to mention state organizations and even local organizations that have to be worked with. And it's a process.
Yeah, well, we're so grateful for you being here. I want to put it out there one more time. If you are coming to Ducks and Donuts and you don't know what you're doing, and that's what's keeping you from being there, reach out to me and Brian, and we'll make sure you're taken care of. We have the resources, and we have tons of guys that want to help you. And we'd like to make sure that Endo has a successful Ducks and Donuts. And if you're not, my kids will definitely enjoy it. So,
Ron will enjoy the donuts and the pancakes.
Well, it'll be a good event. You know it. Because we missed it. We missed it in 2020, and I know that you guys were able to put on something out there and to make things happen. And so we're looking forward to getting back. Our folks are pretty excited to be there, and I'd have a bunch more of my crew there, but they're doing a fishing clinic somewhere else for another group, Hispanic Access Group, I believe, out at Lake Mead. They're going to be doing some things for that group. So, you know, they love what they do. They're dedicated to the public and especially to youth and teaching about wildlife and conservation and the recreational part of it.
Well, I guess we're about ready to wrap this one up. We appreciate you being out with us, Doug, and, you know, all the things that Endow does for these kids and for us and, you know, everybody. So October 23rd, 4 a.m., Overton Wildlife Management Area. If you don't know where it is, you can come in off I-15, get off at the Overton exit, take it all the way through town, and it'll be on your left-hand side just across from, you'll see the mine right on the side.
Start going up a hill, you've gone too far.
Yeah, and so be there. It'll be a great time. It'll be awesome for the kids. Let your kids learn some stuff. So, man, I appreciate you being here, Doug, and spending the time with us. I know you're super busy, and you got so much going on that it's great that we could have you in.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So, you know, like we always say, if you're going to go out hunting this weekend, make sure you take somebody with you if you can. If you're going to take somebody with you, why don't you go ahead and teach them something? If you can't take somebody or teach one, make sure you hunt hard.
Thanks, guys.